Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending on where you are in the world, and welcome to another episode of Dark Reading Radio. I'm Sarah Peters, and our topic for today is 10 security vulnerabilities that every enterprise should be aware of. I'm going to shortly pass it over to our editor-in-chief, Tim Wilson, who will be your host for today. But before I do that, just want to fill you in on a little housekeeping. If you're joining us live, you may have noticed that we have a live text chat happening alongside of our show. We'll be on air with our audio portion for about 30 minutes, and after that time, our guests for today and Tim will be heading on over and participating in that text chat. But that doesn't mean that you can't get involved with that right now. So we'll be participating in that section, maybe taking a couple questions from that, and don't be shy. Hop in that right now. So without further ado, I'm going to pass it over to Tim Wilson.
Thanks, Sarah. I'm really looking forward to the conversation today. We have a couple of great speakers on a topic that is very frequently in the news here at Dark Reading. Almost every day we talk about new vulnerabilities and new threats that are coming to enterprises and issues that you all have to deal with every day. Whether it's patching or vulnerability scanning, application vulnerability testing, all of these things are part of the security professional's day-to-day life of fighting fires and that sort of thing. We have a couple of speakers today who will talk you through some of the latest vulnerabilities that they're seeing that are of concern, and we'll talk a little bit about the direction of vulnerabilities, what we're seeing in the dark web, and what types of exploits we're seeing and that sort of thing. Before I get into that, I want to introduce our two speakers. We have today with us Mike Pittenger, the Vice President of Security Strategy at Black Duck Software. Mike has 30 years of experience in technology and business, more than 25 years of management experience, 15 years in security. He previously served as VP and General Manager of the product division of AppStake. After AppStake's acquisition by Symantec, he led the spin-out of his team to form Veracode. He later served as Vice President of the product and training division at Sigital. For the past several years, he's consulted independently, helping security companies identify, define, and prioritize the benefit to customers of their technology structure solutions appropriately and bring those offerings to market. So welcome, Mike.
Thanks, Tim.
Our other speaker today is Jeremiah Grossman. I'm just going to read you his bio. I like the way this one is written. Professional hacker, black belt in Brazilian jiu-jitsu, off-road racer, and founder of White Hat Security. Jeremiah Grossman's career spans nearly 20 years, and he has lived a literal lifetime in computer security to become one of the industry's biggest names. Jeremiah has received a number of industry awards, has been publicly thanked by Microsoft, Mozilla, Google, Facebook, and many others for his security research, and privately informing them of weaknesses in their systems. He has written hundreds of articles and white papers. Collectively, it's no surprise Jeremiah has been featured in the Wall Street Journal, Forbes, CNN, New York Times, and, of course, the most important publication in the world, Dark Reading. And they regularly rely on his expertise. A highly experienced industry veteran, Jeremiah has been a guest speaker on six continents at hundreds of events, including TED, Black Hat Briefings, RSA, and many top universities. All of this was after Mr. Grossman served as Information Security Officer at Yahoo. So welcome, Jeremiah.
Thank you very much for that, Tim, and it's good to be here.
Well, you know, one of the reasons that we're talking about this today is, you know, we're not all that far from Black Hat, and that's the conference where we start to see some of the new vulnerabilities emerging. I know a lot of those vulnerabilities aren't out yet, but you know, as we're looking at application vulnerabilities. I was hoping that you could maybe talk a little bit about trends that you're seeing. You know, over the last year or so, what kinds of vulnerabilities are we seeing in applications, and where are we finding them? Or is it in off the shelf stuff, or is it mostly in internally developed applications? Gary, do you want to take a crack at that? Just talk a little bit about what kinds of things we're seeing right now.
Sure. So I've been in the web security space for a long, long time, mostly helping defend websites and other web-based applications. And, when web security really got started, you could go to any search box on any website and find a cross-site scripting vulnerability. But these days, it's getting much, much harder. So we've made a lot of progress, which is not to say that we're still not buried in apps and vulnerabilities everywhere. Simply by the nature of that, there's nearly a billion websites on the Internet right now. And in many ways, we don't have a lot of new vulnerabilities that we have to grapple with and worry about. It's new ways of finding and exploiting the same vulnerabilities in systems. And those would be, things like cross-site scripting, SQL injection. And SQL injection is the interesting one because it's, in terms of pervasiveness, it's not that widespread. It probably affects maybe between 4 and 8% of websites, depending on how you look at it. But it causes a lot of damage. And when you have something as big as the web, a bone even like that cause a lot of damage. So, just to run down the quick list, what types of issues that, I worry about or I tell those that I work with to look at, it's, SSL issues, not having SSL or SSL set up properly, TLS if you prefer, cross-site scripting, obviously, SQL injection, and then also stolen credentials. We see all the time massive databases of drop credentials, and then those usernames and passwords reused on other sites to hack those systems. So for me, those are the big ones.
Yeah, that's a really good point across the board there, Jeremiah. I mean, and as you know, for the last couple of years, I've really looked at this through the lens of open source. And if you go to the best empirical data we have, which is NVD, unfortunately, if you look at the types of vulnerabilities, it's pretty evenly split between commercial and open source. So it's not that either is more secure or less secure than the others. But the same types of vulnerabilities that you mentioned with the addition of buffer overflow seem to be the dominant types if you organize it by CWE. Again, from our standpoint, it's not a matter of, open source being more or less secure, but we do see a growing recognition that there are some characteristics about open source that make it particularly attractive to attackers, irrespective of the attack vector or irrespective of the type of vulnerability. And that's basically, the code is available to everyone, so it makes it simpler for an attacker to research versus doing black box testing of commercial code. We go to the trouble of publicly disclosing these vulnerabilities when they're found and often include an exploit. The components, if you look at things like, OpenSSL or the C library, they're ubiquitous. So it's a real target-rich environment for the attackers. And lastly, and probably most importantly, it's kind of got a reverse support model from what we see in commercial software. So if you elect to use open source, you're now responsible for continuing to monitor that over time and having awareness of when there's an update, when there's a vulnerability, and then making an election whether or not to pull that new component into your code base.
Mike, do you want to talk a little bit about why is that important? You and I have had conversations about the use of open source code. Maybe some of our audience might not be aware of how pervasive that is, even in off-the-shelf applications and other applications that we think of as really being written, in an original form, actually use lots of code that's already been out there or that's already been open source. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, thanks. We've really seen a sea change in how open source is viewed, and it's now being embraced by financial services, by the government. When Black Duck got started, it was kind of surprising to see open source in an application. If you're looking at in-house applications, it's now not unusual to see an in-house application, back office application, be comprised of 75% open source or 80% open source. We published some research back in April about commercial applications. So these are applications that we've analyzed typically in as part of the due diligence in an M&A transaction. And these are, you know, apps might be 3, 5, 10 years old. But even in those cases, open source comprises over 35% of the average application. And if you look at raw numbers, that means the average application had over 100 individual open source components in it. And just trying to keep track of that many components, in a single application is difficult. But if you're a big company and you have, 100 or 1,000 applications in your app inventory, it can be really unmanageable.
Thanks, Mike. One of the things that we've been talking about a little bit is what application security issues the enterprise security manager should be looking at. And, one place that we're seeing issues right now is at the endpoint. And, Jeremiah, I know you have a new position where you're really looking at that. Do you want to talk a little bit about where you're going in the industry and how you see the endpoint security issue and the AppSec issue kind of coming together?
Sure. Most people know me from White Hat Security being the founder, and I did that for 15 years and did a lot of good stuff in web security. And I wanted to branch out and look at new things and explore new challenges. And one of the big problems that I saw out there was, of course, malware, and most specifically ransomware, because it's just rocking up as a problem. And that was a good opportunity for me to jump in and help make an impact. So I joined SentinelOne as a chief of security strategy and looking at this problem and trying to figure out ways we can get the incentives to go in the right direction. Because what happens is when you look at a breach, depending on the industry vertical, the bad guys will use some kind of web vulnerability to break into the system. But after they break into the system, then they'll pivot, find something that they like, and then land malware as far and wide as they can. And that malware might be ransomware, many different forms, spyware, command and control, and things like that. So my focus right now is really ransomware and how it affects the endpoints. Now, ransomware and endpoints can compromise any number of ways, but the two big ones are drive-by downloads through insecure browsers or browser components like Flash or Java, or email-borne malware where the user voluntarily double-clicks on it. And as we well know, the detection methods of the traditional AV is not something that would impress anybody. I think the latest studies were like a 50-50 coin flip on detection. And the signature process of going about detection with signatures on the floor just isn't good. So instead, if you have to take a behavioral approach to it, where look at runtime and how the malware actually executes, or ransomware specifically, you'll see stark differences if you're looking at the behavior of it from normal everyday applications. So I wanted to get the next step in the cyber kill chain after the vuln. Now, let's assume that the bad guy's an exploitable, and let's see if we can stop the malware.
Okay, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. This is great. I just wanted to kind of give a level set for where you two are coming from. And I want to give you a chance to talk about specific vulnerabilities that you're watching right now. But before I do that, let me remind the audience that we're in about 15 minutes at the bottom of the hour. We'll be joining a chat session, which you will find there on your screen if you registered through the Dark Reading website. And we hope that as many of you can jump in and join the conversation when we reach that point. I want to talk before we get into specifics. Let's talk a little bit about security vulnerabilities in general. As an editor, I look at the reports that come into me, and it seems like we're seeing more vulnerabilities than ever. We get reports all the time from independent security researchers, from vendors, in reports. Is it just my perception that there's a lot more vulnerabilities now than there were, say, 2 years ago, or are we really seeing a real proliferation of application vulnerabilities, sort of across the industry? Either one of you, do you want to take a crack at, you know, is it a perception thing, or are we really seeing more vulnerabilities now?
Yeah, this is Mike. I think we are actually seeing more vulnerabilities, and I think the reason is pretty simple. It's that there's a lot more attention to this, and frankly, there are more people who are capable of doing good research into it. So, we're seeing more widespread use of tools, and obviously those are helpful in identifying common coding errors during the SDLC that could lead to vulnerabilities. But most of these that are being identified post-deployment, whether it's in commercial or open source, are being found by security researchers. I mean, we saw a huge spike 2 years ago in kind of the six-month period following the Heartbleed disclosure, just as it generated more and more interest. And you know, it, while Heartbleed made a lot of news, less news has been made about the 70 or so new vulnerabilities or additional vulnerabilities that have been disclosed in OpenSSL since then. So I think we're seeing more. It's also, we've kind of reached a choke point on the reporting side of things with the National Vulnerability Database. They're having a real hard time keeping up. We use also a resource called VulnDB that has about 50% more vulnerabilities than NVD, and it's simply because they have the manpower to provide those. And you may have seen this has kind of been the spur for a thing called DWF, or Distributed Weakness Findings, basically trying to broaden reporting responsibility beyond the 20 or so CNAs that are work with MITRE on this, or with NIST on this.
I'm going to definitely agree with Mike here. I think there's two factors at play that caused the rise of more vulns. One is we have a lot more code, but that's not going to move the needle all that much. But I think Mike is 100% right. We have a lot more people capable of finding vulnerabilities out there, whether it's in the operating system, plugins, or even web applications. And then you have a lot more corp companies and organizations out there who are writing code, shipping code, that have vulnerability assessment programs, and these have to get published. And then larger as an industry, we're getting better at awareness. Before, you could find a vulnerability, try to disclose it, and no one would really pay attention to you. And if they did, they'd put it on some to fix later kind of list, and there would be no attention on it whatsoever. So I think while we see these scary vulnerability headlines all the time, I'm actually encouraged by that particular trend, because it means that getting awareness out there, that's one less vuln we have to worry about. And so I find all these to be, for the most part, positives.
Sure. Do you think that what we've seen, the emerging bug bounty programs in companies and sort of on a broad industry basis, we've seen a couple of companies that have emerged that, basically are bug bounty businesses. Do you think that the fact that there's a little, more incentive now to find vulnerabilities and get them published is changing the way that we see disclosure?
Bug bounty as a style of vulnerability assessment is a business model that couldn't come soon enough. It just 5 years ago was one that really couldn't be done. The ecosystem of testers just wasn't there, and also the customer, the market, really wasn't ready to pay for to allow I should say anybody and everybody to hack their software or their website. So that's a new maturity level that the industry has approached. The cool part about bug bounty is it's able to engage much, much more people out there in the world and keep the vulns per dollar number as low as humanly possible. And I can only – and it's not going to really replace too much as far as the vulnerability assessment side or source code review side. Those processes will continue internally, but they're going to be incomplete and they're going to be imperfect, and vulnerable code will ship to the public. But then if you can get the public on your side to help you find those for – pennies, this is really going to benefit everybody. And I'm very pleased that the bug bounty model is coming up, and we're seeing, blue chip companies like United Airlines and, Western Union get in on the act.
Mike, does the bug bounty situation affect the open source space? I mean, in open source, there isn't a body that's necessarily willing to jump in and pay for vulnerabilities to be disclosed. How does How does bug bounty affect the open source space?
Yeah, it's a good question, and it is a problem. You know, some of the Linux group, for instance, is trying to organize more around better disclosure and so on. HackerOne, I believe, has after the fact bounty program where they'll pick the open source bug of the quarter or something like that. But they're the communities vary in size, they vary in maturity, but they share the common feature of not having any cash to pay for this. So it's it is a problem. They benefit from the fact that there are a lot of people who are really into open source, and they like the idea behind it, and they're willing to devote their time and efforts to helping. I know some of the tool vendors also work with those communities pre-release of a new version of a component to help identify and take care of some of the low-hanging fruit. But the fact remains, we're seeing, at its core, the tools are really good at finding the common coding errors, cross-site scripting, SQL injection, things like that, the types of vulnerabilities that are being disclosed in open source, and the way open source is built make it a much more challenging effort for the automated tools. So a lot of this is still going to just be security researchers.
Okay, good. Yeah, I'm curious about, for the average IT organization, the security organization, we talked about the proliferation of vulnerabilities, but the tools are better too than they were maybe a couple of years ago. We have a lot better vulnerability scanning tools. We see organizations using penetration testing. Would you say that today that it's easier or harder for the average company to identify the vulnerabilities that affect them and get them remediated quickly than it was maybe a couple of years ago? Either one of
them. Yeah, I think the adoption of static and dynamic analysis has been terrific from a security standpoint. The tools have come a long way from when we started Veracode 10 years ago. They're faster. They build a better abstract syntax tree. They're finding more and more stuff. But if you look at the data, NVD has 76,000 or so CVEs listed. And so full disclosure, I didn't go through all of them, but I made an assumption that if I were a tool vendor and I found a bug in an open source component or a commercial component out in the wild, I'd make sure people knew I found it with my tool. And if you look at those 76,000, only 60 or 70 mention a vendor, and 50 of those are for bugs in the vendor's tools. So we're looking at a pretty small feature set. And then I suspect you'll agree with me on this. I mean, security is an ephemeral thing. The tools are good at providing a snapshot of the security of a specific build, typically during the SDLC. But the threat space changes so quickly that you need to continue to monitor in our world, new vulnerabilities in the open source components that you use, and new disclosures from the commercial vendors that you're using.
So I think I think Mike is right on the money. I think if you compare the last 5 or 10 years, companies, whoever the organization is, we've gotten very good as an industry in finding vulnerabilities, so many vulnerabilities that we are just buried. I can't tell you how many different companies I've run into where maybe they just got to only 10% of testing of their websites or their web code or whatever, and they're already buried in so many vulns that they don't know how to fix them. So, yes, it's way easier to find vulnerabilities now. The people, a lot more people are there, a lot more tools are there, a lot more options are there. Which brings up the other side. It actually gave rise to a completely different problem that we should have expected, and that's remediation. Remediation is still an absolute pain when you're talking about just general patching, or more specifically, the fixing of custom web application vulnerabilities. And that is what really slows an organization down or slows down an AppSec program. And if you look at the stats, whether they're from Veracode, White Hat, HP, the time to fix rates are in the weeks, if not months, and the remediation rates hover around 50 to 60%. So if there's innovation and need to solve yet another problem in software security, web security, it's on the remediation. It's on the remediation side. Because it doesn't do anybody much good just to find a mountain of vulnerabilities if you're not going to actually fix them. That's where we have to focus.
And this all argues for, you know, for pushing this, the testing and awareness earlier and earlier into the SDLC, right? So if you can find these bugs as you're writing the code, fixing them becomes a much more efficient exercise than I think the BSIM community estimated it was between 80 and 100 hours of organizational time to remediate a single bug found post-deployment.
It's technically right, but I think for me you have to split the world between code that's actively managed, actively developed, and all the legacy stuff. So if we're writing new code now over the, you know, let's just say we're restrict our thinking to active code projects, absolutely, you know, put as much, you know, emphasis on security in the SDLC as you can, because it is disruptive, it is expensive to fix vulnerabilities after deployment. But the other very large problem is the mountain of code that's already in circulation, that's in, you know, software that's in maintenance mode, that no one knows how it really works and how it touches. What do we do with the millions of websites and libraries and whatever else that's already riddled with vulns that have no SDLC, let alone a security SDLC? So I think we have to look at these two types of software very differently from a strategy point of view.
Yeah, very good point.
My temptation is to go down this secure application development path, but we're almost at the end of our half an hour here, and I wanted to make sure that I gave you both a chance to maybe flag one or two vulnerabilities that you're watching right now that you think you know, maybe aren't getting enough attention these days. Jer, why don't you start us? Give us a, you know, just maybe one or two. I know it's hard to choose because there's so many out there, but are there a couple of things that you think people should especially be watching right now?
I think when it comes to, let's say, you know, I did a lot of web security. Let's talk a little bit about endpoint stuff. So I think endpoint is affected by, you know, two real things. You know, one is the inbound emails and the other one is the browser. And I spend a lot of time doing browser security. And the one I'm watching is not so much the vuln. You know, vulns are kind of temporal, they'll come and go, but it's the avenues of attack that most interest me. I'm watching very closely on the elimination of Flash from the browser in favor of anything else, but that probably is a HTML5. We cannot ban Java and Flash in the browser fast enough. I think if we do that, the core of the browsers are actually very, very good, whether you're talking, you know, Edge, Chrome, Firefox, or whatever. But, you know, if you're looking at that, those two conduits, email and browser, those drive-by downloads are killing us, and it's really the plugins that the bad guys are going after, Flash and Java.
Yeah, that's one of those things where, you know, when you tell users that they need to be turning Java off, you know, most of the time, then it's time for us all to be thinking about whether or not we really need Java in the browser from a security standpoint.
Fortunately, all it looks like all the browser vendors are angling that way on the elimination of those particular third-party plugins. You know,
yep.
they're going down the click-to-play route rather than default enable, and that's a welcome trend.
Okay, Mike, how about you? Do you see are there one or two things that you're seeing that you think people should especially be paying attention to?
Well, if you go back to the report we issued in April, so we looked at a couple of hundred commercial applications. It's not a specific vulnerability, but it's just to draw the point. We were seeing an average of over 20 vulnerabilities in the average commercial application just in the open source components. More striking to me was that the average age of those vulnerabilities, it was over 5 years. From the time the vulnerability was disclosed until we did the evaluation of the application. So it's really just kind of code hygiene, understanding what you're using and why. You know, we saw another example of this in the Mossack Fonseca debacle a couple of months ago. In terms of specific vulnerabilities, favorite might be the wrong term, but the one that comes to mind is the glibc vulnerability that we saw Google and Red Hat disclose in February. I liked it, first of all, because they didn't come up with a clever branding exercise over it. But the glibc library is, I mean, it's central to every Linux distro out there. So this had an impact across IT infrastructure, mission-critical applications, so things inside and outside of the SDLC. It can affect the Internet of Things. And what we see, based on the fact that, you know, the average vulnerability in the commercial applications is over 5 years old, this is a gift that's going to keep on giving for a long time, because people just aren't aware of it. We saw the same thing in an analysis of the Docker containers, not for this vulnerability specifically, but we looked at Docker Hub, and the vast majority of the approved containers had vulnerabilities that were in the Linux stack that were months or years old. And containers are, because of the way people use them in the DevOps environment, they might strip off the application layer and put another app on top of the Linux stack. These things just kind of propagate throughout an organization.
Well, I want to thank you both for being here on the audio portion of our discussion. I have more questions, and I'm hoping our audience does too. So, Sarah, why don't you remind us how to get into the chat, and we'll go from there.
Well, it's pretty easy, because if you're listening to our broadcast right now, all you have to do is scroll down your page and look where it says live chat. Scroll down a little bit more, and it says your post. All you have to do is type a little message into there, scroll down a little bit more. There's a red button that says post, and voila, you're in there. You're in like Flynn, and we will be all participating in that chat right now. So don't be shy. Jump right in. And thank you again to Tim and to Jeremiah and to Mike. Thank you to all of you who are joining us today. And please come back again to see us next month, when we will have another episode of Dark Reading Radio. And we'll also be heading out shortly thereafter to Black Hat, where we may be having some special episodes of Dark Reading Radio from Black Hat. So keep your eyes and ears open for that news as well. Anything else, Tim, before I close out this wonderful episode?
No, just thanks to these guys for our audience. These are two of the smartest guys in AppSec that there are out there. So please take advantage of talking with them if you have a chance on our chat, and we'll look forward to hearing more about vulnerabilities being disclosed at Black Hat, which takes place in the first week in August in Las Vegas. So. Thanks, Sarah, for that.
All right, and thanks again to all of you in the audience. We wouldn't do it without you. So have a great day. We'll talk to you again next episode.
Thanks, all.